So I think it is important as we navigate what's going on in this country that we focus on some things, some key pieces of the conversations that we're having, and making sure as we're all trying to get on the same page on a whole host of issues and navigating what I think are very clearly muddy waters in some instances, that we remain honest, that we remain using facts, not just emotions, to discuss anything we happen to be discussing, and focus on being united. Unfortunately, the way some people on both sides of a whole host of issues, the way that they're talking has been dishonest, has been using little facts, and has been, in some cases, I think, purposefully divisive. This is a country that was built on some fundamental truths. Fundamental truths that freedom is what brings us all together. That's, in fact, what unites us. Freedom. Freedom to live without being unjustly murdered by a cop in Minneapolis. Freedom to express an opinion. An opinion that even if activists threatening, looting, and rioting don't actually like, you still have the freedom to express it. And some people want to divide us. Some people want to make this an us versus them, and I don't think that's going to serve anyone. You can fundamentally believe that George Floyd was murdered while also fundamentally believing that defunding the police is dangerous, that destroying businesses, it's counterproductive, that looting is immoral. We're not talking about mutually exclusive topics. You can believe, as I do, everything that I just said. I believe George Floyd was murdered. I believe the cops need to go to jail. I also believe that defunding the police is dangerous, that destroying businesses doesn't get us anywhere, and that looting is fundamentally wrong. I believe all of those things. And it's not wrong to have all of those beliefs. It's not wrong to have some of those beliefs. You get to believe what you want to believe. But there's some folks who want you to think that it's us versus them, that you have to go all in on one side or you're part of the problem, that if you're not with us, you're against us. And we've seen some of that language, frankly, on both sides. We played the audio last hour of Steven Jackson, the former NFL star. He literally says us versus them. And I would argue that that's a bigger danger than any issues that we'll ever discuss on the show or in society at large. This idea that you have to be us versus them. Because fundamentally, if we want to change anything, literally anything, it can't just be about us versus them. Sometimes the way it's set up, it's automatically perceived that way, right? We have an election. It is one side versus the other. We have teams, one team taking on the other team. But if you consider them the enemy and you start to talk about them in ways that are just deeply divisive, you're not going to win. Ultimately, I don't think you're going to win. That you're either with one side or the other is the antithesis to what makes this country so great, the greatest on earth. We have a constitution that gives us the right to be free, the right to worship, the right to defend oneself, the right to debate issues. And I want to talk about debating issues. Because what gets in the way of those freedoms, which, by the way, should easily, clearly unite all of us, are the folks who want to stop the conversations from taking place. That you're either with us or against us. And if you don't agree with every single thing that comes out of my mouth, you're against us. No, I'm sorry. That's not true. There are some folks who are taking advantage of a movement in ways that does not forward any conversation and won't lead to any fundamental change, whatever that fundamental change may mean to you. Let us be very clear. When we saw the video of what happened to George Floyd, the country was overwhelmingly united in anger, in disgust, in anxiety, maybe in terror, maybe in vulnerability. Everyone agreed that what happened to George Floyd was murder, was wrong, was disturbing, was disgusting. Everyone was united in wanting to see that cop arrested and charged. People took to the streets in anger. Unfortunately, there were some that used this to pat themselves on the back on social media to suddenly tell us that this is where they stand. They've always stood this way. They've never actually said it before, but here is a meme to talk about how amazing I am, how heroic I am. Now, that kind of stuff bothers me because, sorry, if you're so united, this would not be the first time that you speak up. You're united against bigotry? Really? Where were you in February? We talked about this yesterday. Where were you in February when Jews were getting beat up on the streets of New York and New Jersey almost every single day? I didn't hear from anybody. If the goal is to be united for some sort of change, you actually have to want change and not want to present yourself as a hero. But we talked about that yesterday. Today, I want to talk about what's driving us apart, the ones that are asking us without any debate whatsoever to take some rather dangerous positions. Dangerous fringe positions. And to get us to agree with these fringe positions, the first thing they have to do is divide us, and we have to be aware of that. We can't let that happen. We should not defund the police as some activists want us to, as some check marks on Twitter want us to, as the Black Lives Matter political movement wants us to. It's on their website. I can't get behind defunding the police. There are loud voices out there that I don't think represent even close to a majority of any movement that we're seeing. But they're loud voices. And some of them bully. Some of them play the system, so they are considered more meaningful than all of the other millions of people who are out on the streets. And I think they realize that. So how exactly do you get a movement where you're the smallest voice but appear to be the loudest? How do you get everybody else behind you on a position that I believe to be fringe, such as defunding the police? Well, you create a scapegoat. You create an enemy. You make it us versus them. You make it purposefully divisive. And they're no longer just blaming Derek Chauvin, this cop from Minneapolis. They're not just blaming him. They've decided to turn this into blaming all cops everywhere. Every single one is supposed to be painted by the exact same brush. That Derek Chauvin is not the outlier. He is the reality. And I don't believe that. A rallying cry for some protesters that you've seen tagged on walls, ACAB. Have you seen that? Spray painted, tagged on the sides of businesses in Seattle. When I went to downtown Seattle this past weekend to see the aftermath of the Saturday night riot, I saw ACAB everywhere. ACAB, all cops are bastards.
Who are you?
I'm with Kyber Radio. What were you just chanting? Chris Monfort was right?
Yeah.
Why do you feel that way?
Because all cops are bastards.
So he killed a police officer, you think that's fine?
Yeah, absolutely.
You condone anyone killing a police officer?
Absolutely.
Now, I'm told by some folks in the media and some check marks on Twitter that I have to side with a movement where that voice exists and doesn't get significant pushback. I'm sorry, I'm not ever going to be siding with a movement where that is a voice that is not challenged, that goes unchallenged. I'm never going to side with a group that tells me all cops are bastards because all cops are not bastards. 99% of the cops heroically put on that uniform every single day to help protect the neighborhoods, including the one, by the way, that dude lives in. And there are a lot of cops out there right now that are taking a lot of abuse, including physical abuse, being assaulted, having stuff thrown at them, bricks, cinder blocks, frozen water bottles. That is not acceptable. But if you believe that all cops are whatever you want to say, whether it's bastards or evil or racist, understand you are creating a situation that's putting us versus them. You are creating a division where there doesn't have to be. That message doesn't bring me to that tent. And I thought we were supposed to try to be united. We hear from Joe Biden this week talking out against Donald Trump, who is dividing us, but Joe Biden will bring us together. I guess he couldn't bring us together when he was vice president for 8 years, but now he can bring us together. I don't hear him calling out these folks. who are shaming cops. And you know what? I'll give credit where credit's due. I think for the most part, Mayor Jenny Durkan and even Governor Jay Inslee on the topic of at least talking about the difficulties of policing, they have been quite fair to say the cops don't belong to be just put into one little group with Derek Chauvin. That yes, sometimes cops make mistakes and sometimes they're deadly. Sometimes they're not mistakes. Sometimes it's evil. But the vast majority of the cops who are out there are not represented by Derek Chauvin. And they don't deserve to get physically assaulted while trying to keep the peace. And the message that labels all cops as evil, that's not a good message. That's not a uniting message. But some activists and politicians, they think it's easier to bring people to their side with fear and hate, with us versus them. Because, look, fear and hate are incredibly powerful emotions. Uplifting someone is pretty difficult to do when there's so much negativity around. So some of these folks decide to lean into the negative, and it's so much easier to lean into the negative. So you've got folks like Shama Sawan, a Seattle City Councilwoman, who's leaning into the hate and the fear-mongering and espousing a rather dangerous conspiracy theory like this.
Video footage since Saturday has repeatedly revealed that the police are the ones instigating the violence and that, in fact, these seem to be not spontaneous eruptions from the police, but they seem to be coming prepared with instructions to all violence.
Not able to win her argument on the merits. This is someone who wants to defund the police. And I think in her case, one can argue she wants to abolish the police. Unable to win that argument, what she does right there, and you heard it, it's creating us versus them, despite having not just zero proof to back up that conspiracy, but there's overwhelming video evidence suggesting the opposite of what she just said is true. I've been following the looting and the riots and the points where the peaceful protests turn violent. I saw a video on King 5 of people throwing rocks at cops. I saw the video on MSNBC of protesters turning into instigators, and maybe just instigators pretending to be protesters, firing fireworks at the cops. I'm seeing it. Her argument doesn't make sense. On its merit, it doesn't make sense. She wants you to believe that the cops are out there and they are orchestrating violence to stop folks from protesting. Why would you think they do that after waiting all day into a 12, 13, 14, 15, 16-hour day? Why would they wait until the very end of their shift to start to quell peaceful protests? Why not just start at the beginning, use overwhelming force, scare people away from protesting, then call it a day? So they don't have to sit out there, stand out there all day. Her position makes no sense. It doesn't have to. She's not counting on people listening and thinking about what it is she said. She wants to get a visceral reaction. All cops are bastards. That's what she wants. Now, I don't find that, to be honest. I don't find that to be uniting. I find that to be purposefully divisive. But we're being told by the movement that we're seeing and hearing from on the streets of Seattle and Olympia and Mill Creek and all across this country that we need to be united. This is not uniting us. This is dividing us. There are so many opportunities to unite us. We started united. We started united against what happened to George Floyd, and then we got divided because when politics get involved, when activists get involved on either side, when they have a different motive than wanting to get us all on the same page under one specific issue and instead push an ideologically driven policy, then people start to get divided. There's an argument going on right now, a conversation it was supposed to be, about what can be done to quell the riots. On the one hand, you've got politicians making it worse and some activists making it worse, claiming that the riots, claiming that the looting is somehow morally just, that it's acceptable. It's not. This is, in fact, a clear position that most people should be able to take and be united with. Destroying business is wrong. Stealing things is wrong. I get angry all the time on issues. You're going to say my anger is justified if I go ahead and burn something down? Of course not, unless you agree with it. And then maybe we get a little bit more willing to justify. That's dangerous. That's wrong. If that's the case, why have courts? Why do we have a legal system? Why do we have a legal system? Why do we have a judge? Why do we have a jury of our peers? But Jason, there's problems with the judicial system. Okay, let's address those problems, not get rid of the entire judicial system. Jason, cops are all wrong. Okay, how about this? Let's have a conversation about how we can fix what you perceive to be wrong. But let's make sure that we're basing it in facts. President Trump pushed an idea to use the U.S. military as a solution to the violence that we're seeing in some of the states. Now, the good news is last night we saw a lot less of it. But that was his plan. Senator Tom Cotton, in an editorial that was published in the New York Times, he backed it up. Now, this is where the politicking comes into play. We can disagree on the ways to go about quelling the violence. I think that is fair. That is reasonable. You can disagree with Tom Cotton and the president. Go for it. But I'm wondering if there are some folks out there who don't think they can win any debate on the merits of their argument, whatever it is. I think fearing that they can't win, what they decide to do is change the argument. They decided to completely change the argument. Elise Jordan, a journalist, a political analyst over at MSNBC, she was horrified that we might use American troops against protesters. Is that what the president said? Is that what Tom Cotton said?
The chair of the joint staff was extremely compromised the day prior when he chose to walk across that park that had been cleared by chemical agents, American protesters, the American people, just as Secretary of Defense Mark Esper also was compromised. Everyone who chose to go along. And so in retrospect, a day later, there were regrets, as there should be. It's absolutely horrifying that we're at this inflection point where we're even questioning using American troops to practice counterinsurgency across the country.
I'll let her finish. She's got about 24 seconds left. She's either purposefully trying to divide us by positing something that's not being discussed. No one is saying use American troops to go after peaceful protesters or protesters at all. Or she's conflating protesting and rioting and looting and thereby literally justifying the action. I think there's a huge difference between a peaceful protester who is upset, even if they don't have a solution, they just want to get out there and be upset. I think there is a huge difference between someone like that and someone who wants to turn to violence or looting, whether it's driven by an Antifa-style ideology, which we're going to talk about later on this hour, or if it's based purely on opportunism. I think there's a huge difference. So either she doesn't, or she's purposefully trying to divide us by claiming that the president said, or Tom Cotton said, or anyone is saying that we should be using American troops to go after peaceful protesters.
What are we thinking? Have we absolutely lost our minds? And Donald Trump has been so protected by the norms that keep ex-generals and ex-officials from speaking out. Because of those norms, there hasn't been outcry from the very beginning, as there probably should be, because of the grave danger that Donald Trump poses to democracy.
Okay. So is this about you going after Donald Trump, or is this about you trying to unite this country? Now, some people have justified the divisiveness because they think Donald Trump is evil and they think the ends justify the means. They think what they're doing can be justified. That's dangerous because you know what? There are lots of people on the opposite side that can take the exact same issue. They think what you're trying to do to President Trump is evil and dangerous. And so they may end up doing things to justify their position, and I don't want to see that happen. And that we can't come together and say very clearly in one voice that violence is wrong, violence is deadly, cops are being killed, people are being beat up, businesses destroyed. If we can't come together, what can then we come together at this point? Do we want this to end, or do we want to be held hostage by people who don't necessarily have our best interest in mind? You can choose to unite around wanting to stop looters and rioters while also honoring what we need to have happen to get justice for George Floyd. Why doesn't she choose to do the uniting? Why not just have an argument about the method that President Trump or Tom Cotton have proposed? Why not just do that? Why decide to completely change the debate? Why decide to completely ignore what people are actually proposing? You can have protests and have them be peaceful. Again, it should be what we inspire each other to do. It should be aspirational, and it should be inspirational. Instead of making excuses, instead of justifying violence, why don't we look around the country where the peaceful protesting is happening without any of the violence? Look what's happening in Miami. Miami Mayor Carlos Jimenez said this to Fox today.
We're fine. We haven't had trouble here since Saturday. We had a little bit of trouble on Saturday, and that was quickly put down. And actually, on Sunday, very peaceful demonstrations. We actually had the community block an attempt by some of the demonstrators to loot a CVS, and the protesters themselves got in front and said no, allowed police to get there and protect the building. But outside of that, it's been pretty, peaceful demonstrations down here with no rioting, no looting, no burning. Outside of this small couple of incidents we had on Saturday, that was it.
Isn't that what we should all want? Instead, why are we saying that that's not possible by essentially saying it's not possible when you justify the violence? I think you can get your point made effectively without hurting people, without hurting businesses, without hurting other protesters, and without hurting cops, because right now, cops are under assault. Here's Lauren Green from Fox News.
Right, Steve. Well, late last night, those three NYPD police officers were wounded, but all of them are expected to survive. Now, two officers were patrolling the streets of Brooklyn, trying to protect local businesses from looting, when a man approached them with a knife, stabbing one of the officers in the neck. Fellow officers responded immediately, exchanging gunfire with the perpetrator. Two officers were shot in the hand. All three wounded officers are in stable condition, and they are expected to recover. Now, the suspect was also shot and is in critical condition. And this incident follows other attacks on cops in recent days. This week, a sergeant was struck by a black sedan in the Bronx, and another officer was beat up on the street.
I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to live in that world where we are okay with this. And there are too many voices that are choosing either to justify or not speak up against this kind of stuff. And the fact of the matter is there are some people out there who are disingenuous with what it is they're proposing. I believe Shama Sawant's ideas are dangerous. I believe Tammy Morales justifying looting is dangerous. And I think Antifa is dangerous. When we come back, we're going to talk with an expert from the FBI who now is in charge of an investigative firm. He has studied white supremacists and Antifa and anarchists, and to him, it seems pretty clear who's responsible. We're going to get into that conversation when we come back on the Jason Rant Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rant Show on AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. Though there have certainly been some exceptions, the more we learn about what we're seeing as peaceful protests end up turning violent, the more clear it seems to become that Antifa, anarchists, various groups associated with their ideologies are actually behind a lot of the attacks on law enforcement and the looting against businesses that we've been seeing all across the country. My next guest spent 25 years with the FBI. He spent time supervising an FBI squad in the Midwest that investigated militia, neo-Nazis, and anarchist groups. James Casey is the president of FCS Global Advisors, an investigative and crisis management firm, and he joins me now. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So you've essentially tracked and studied both the neo-Nazi movements in this country as well as the anarchists and sort of the subsets of what anarchists do. on an editorial on The Hill, you basically say, look, it's unlikely that the white supremacist groups are behind this, despite some of the earlier reports. So explain what led you to that conclusion.
Sure. And this is based on my experience, and I'll caveat that it goes back a couple years. But when I was supervising the squad in the Midwest, and I'll leave the city out because I expect that some of these groups are still there, and I expect the FBI is still looking at them. But I had the opportunity to, you know, literally investigate both of them at the same time and observe their tactics. And for the most part, I don't think they've changed much. We observed that on the neo-Nazi white supremacist side, I won't say they're more organized, they're a little more formal. We kind of knew who they were. They didn't really hide who they were. You know, when they held rallies, often they go and get permits, not because they're going to be good guys about it. A lot of times they're going to bust the permits and then try and get into confrontations with counter protesters and the police, just like we saw in Charlottesville. And then on the other side, you know, Antifa at the time wasn't really a moniker that was used to describe these anarchists, but they were anarchists nonetheless, and they had a completely different set of techniques, and that included being very covert, mm-hmm. very difficult to penetrate, very difficult to figure out who the members were. They called themselves affinity groups, which meant that basically, you know, somebody would start their own little cell. And in fact, we tried to work undercover agents into some of these potential cells that we thought we'd identified, and they would be immediately rejected. And the agents would be told to go start their own cells. You know, appreciate your efforts, but go. You're the leader now of your own affinity group, so you get your own group, and then, you know, we'll weave you into the mix. And so I think that's what we're seeing in some of these more violent protests. And again, I've emphasized in the article and in some mm-hmm. other broadcasts that, you know, these are certainly not all the protesters. We can't throw all these people into totally. One bucket. There are many, many, many peaceful protesters. There are just these anarchists that are in the middle of it, and much of the significant damage you see and violence, quite frankly, is them.
And, you know, part of it is they're sort of tipping us all off. I covered some of the Antifa violence that we've seen in the Pacific Northwest, be it Seattle or Portland, and they are clearly sharing the same tactics that they've done in the past in their, you know, activism as they're doing right now. You've got stories out of New York City where you've got them hiding weapons or staging bricks for individuals to pick up and use. And in Portland, police officers ended up catching someone who was driving supplies into the group. This is how they normally operate.
Yeah, correct. Some of it has been a little bit overblown, not a lot. The bricks I saw, you know, there are several threads going around on social media about, you know, pallets of bricks, and it turns out those are bricks that were there before there were any protests. But there are buckets of bricks and tubs of bricks that have been discovered by NYPD. And you see the bicycles that kind of get deployed ahead of time to divert the police to one place so that mm-hmm. by the time they want to go break out windows and destroy property in another place, there is no police. I've seen pictures of medics, you know, all of a sudden on the scene that clearly aren't EMS. They're their own medics. I mean, who brings medics to a rally? You know, there are these tactics that are taking place.
Now, they will argue that on the medic side, the reason why they're doing that is because the cops are the ones creating all of the violence. We have a socialist Seattle City Council member here in Seattle who argued yesterday that it seems as if there are instructions being given to cops in order to orchestrate the violence. There is a movement right now that is pretending the cops are the only ones engaged in any sort of violence. Is there any evidence to back that up?
No, I mean, that's
it's ridiculous.
Know, I've been in this business for 32 years. It's ridiculous. Are there bad cops out there? Are there cops who have been clearly observed assaulting protesters, including, you know, peaceful protesters and flashing white power signs? Absolutely. They are there. But the police are not the problem here.
Yeah. Jim Casey is the president of FCS Global Advisors. It's an investigative and crisis management firm. We're talking about the evidence that suggests that it is, in fact, Antifa behind the attacks, or anarchy groups and groups that are related. And a point that you made, and you compared the KKK when it first started to how they sort of operated, and then you get into the conversation in your piece in The Hill into Antifa. And what I thought was really interesting is there's a clear difference between why it was so easy to go after KKK versus the Antifa groups. Well, the Antifa groups are dealing with something the KKK really didn't, which is technology.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, when we were working these groups in the Midwest, we had informants and assets inside of the white supremacist group. Many of them would talk to the cops or the FBI, you know, openly. They wouldn't all be informants, but, you know, you knew who they were. You could knock on their door and say, you know, what's going on? You know, what's with the rally that's going to be in 2 weeks? There's no such ability to do something like that with the anarchy groups.
How would you define Antifa?
I define them as a loosely affiliated group of individuals, some of whom many of them not know what Antifa is or says or stands for. They just know that they're in for the, you know, the violence and, you know, whatever is going to go on. And again, we talked about how loosely organized they are. There are a few leaders. I mean, there have to be people that are, you know, sort of orchestrating, you know, where people go and who does what, but they're not a lot of leaders and they're hard to identify. Again, I think it's just there's sort of the movement within the agitators within a crowd of mostly peaceful protesters that kind of break out and do most of the violence you see.
But so you say that it's kind of loosely based, and we've heard similar sentiments basically saying, look, it's not like they have a national charter. They don't have national leaders. I'm looking right now at a Facebook group called Emerald City Antifa. They've been tied to some of the threats that we've seen here. They deny the ties, of course, but you know, we see them posting information that certainly seems to indicate some level of either leadership or at least guidance of the group members. So why would that not be considered a leadership or a sort of a more organized group?
No, I don't disagree with you. I think that it's, again, going back to my experience with the affinity groups, they don't work together.
Yeah.
It'd be very difficult for, you know, a chapter in, you know, Seattle, for example, and a chapter in New York to work together. I don't necessarily agree that there's a whole lot of travel back and forth. I haven't seen evidence of busloads of Antifa mm-hmm. people. I think they can just rally enough instigators in whatever town, you know, there's a protest going on in to do damage.
Well, a line in your piece in The Hill, and by the way, you guys should check it out. It's at thehill.com. A line that stuck out to me: nobody can justify criminal violence, but some are looking for a single least bad scenario that fits their narrow political beliefs to use in assigning blame. And what's interesting here is in Seattle, at least, you've got some folks who don't consider themselves a part of the Antifa movement, but they'll proudly display the Iron Front flag. And their argument is that they are fighting against white supremacy, that they say we can't be the fascists because Antifa, it's anti-fascist. What do you make of the supporters behind Antifa? Is this some sort of romanticized version of what they think they're doing? As a gay Jew, I've been called a fascist and a Nazi because I say Antifa violence is wrong. And so I can't quite figure out just like the mental space that they're operating in here.
You know, I hate to use the word binary, which gets overused for everything, but it has become a binary world. If you're not anti-fascist, you're pro-fascist. And people have accused me of that just for writing this article. Look, I quote Louis Free on this. I'm a policeman, not a politician. I don't take a side one way or the other. I'm just looking at the evidence based on my training experience and calling it the way I see it. And I think that that's definitely the case with people who say, well, if they're anti-fascist, they have to be somewhat good. I don't doubt that people that are anti-fascist have redeeming qualities, but if it includes breaking out windows on every store on Fifth Avenue and calling that progress, I disagree with that. That's criminal behavior.
So what is a solution to trying to prosecute this? We heard from the Attorney General earlier today suggesting that they have evidence that's tied directly to some of these Antifa groups or these Antifa actors. But to your point, if it's loosely based and it's just some individual who maybe is inspired by some of this stuff, it seems kind of difficult to go after.
So my experience was they're very difficult to go after at the front end. This is probably the largest amount of anarchist violence I've seen in my lifetime, and I'm in my 60s. So my point is, if we've rounded up enough of these people, then, you know, good interviews can probably produce some intelligence to law mm-hmm. enforcement, as opposed to the inability to try to develop informants ahead of time, which, as I said, has been extremely difficult for law enforcement to do. So maybe now, after the fact, that they've got enough of these, you know, individuals in custody who see that this is a pretty serious thing that they've been involved in, and they're looking at some significant jail time, and they have good legal advice, that they will start to turn and, you know, roll over on people who are calling the shots.
Last question. Would you consider them a terrorist group?
You know, that's a really hard question. And I've seen good arguments both for and against. I mean, the good argument is clearly it looks like terrorism when you see this, that there's that much violent activity going on.
Driven also by an ideology.
It is driven by an ideology, absolutely. which is the classic definition of terrorism. But, you know, an argument against it is that because I think they are so loosely organized, trying to rope, you know, 50 states worth of potential Antifa members into one large terrorist group. Look, we do that. We did that with ISIS and Al-Qaeda to say, well, you know, they got to have a membership card, or, you know, Bin Laden has passed out the membership cards or something. And it's just not that clean. I also am very, very conscious of civil rights, and I don't want to see an overextension of surveillance and, you know, the violations of people's civil rights for accusations of being, you know, in a, quote, terrorist group.
We do that, though, with white supremacists, correct? And all of us kind of cheer that on. We want to see those people who are committing acts of violence or planning acts of violence to be thrown in jail.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so do I. These folks as well. But that's the thing about, you know, domestic terrorism in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Almost always you can find underlying criminal activity that can be prosecuted.
Yeah. It's a fascinating conversation. Unfortunately, it's not just fascinating, but it's also potentially deadly. We've seen some of the actions that they've taken, and obviously no one wants to continue to see this happen, except, weirdly, some of the people who say that they are proudly anti-fascist, justifying some of the violence. It was a really good piece. Again, it's up at thehill.com. We've been talking with Jim Casey, president of FCS Global Advisors. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. It was great.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rancho. Again, check out the piece. It's up at thehill.com. More coverage when we return right here on KTTH. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH on this Thursday afternoon. Thank you so much, by the way, for tuning in all this week so far. I really do appreciate it. But if you missed any moments of the show, go ahead and send me a text with the keyword podcast. Podcast. Text podcast to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll go ahead and send you a link so you can catch up on everything you have missed. There is a bigger conversation going on right now concerning the rights of landlords. And if you haven't sensed the trend of the last hour of the show today, there's a theme of us versus them. That was very intentional, because I'm seeing a lot of stories that perfectly highlight the way we do the us versus them and actually never get anywhere. We shouldn't be saying us versus them with Antifa. It should be all of us saying violence is wrong, period. Not justifying them so it becomes a debate as to whether or not you stand for fascism. No one stands for fascism. And a similar theme is popping up as the governor just extended another 60 days, his moratorium on evictions, rental evictions. And we talked a little bit about this yesterday, but go ahead and protect people who are vulnerable, but understand that you're also creating a vulnerable class of folks. In this case, it's going to be the landlords. I know there's this weird belief that all of these landlords are filthy rich. They've got all of these huge properties. They are millionaires, and they are screwing over the renter. Well, I'm sure there are some really, really bad landlords. Most of them, aren't evil, aren't bad. All they want to do is make a living and service their customers, their renters. And what isn't really understood in this idea that, oh my gosh, we've got to stop all these evil landlords from booting people out who aren't paying rent. Well, they're suffering too, the landlords. Here's one, Kurt Bidwell, talking with TNT, Tacoma News Tribune.
There's really a small percentage of people that get a legal eviction, and yet they're taking huge action that affects the broad range of housing providers. I really see them vilifying landlords and creating this us and them mentality instead of we have a service, we have a customer, we want to meet the needs and come together with them.
He said it himself, us versus them. It's an us versus them mentality right now. That is obviously not what we want, because as we've been talking about this hour, us versus them doesn't actually work. Us versus them doesn't let anyone come together. And when you have us versus them, it turns out you're not actually listening to the concerns that they have.
They're putting more burdens on us that gives us less margin to be able to do the maintenance, the repairs, the turnover costs that most of us are doing ourselves. We're independent housing providers. We're small business people. You know, we have the typical landlord only has a couple of properties. And so to add those costs and then to extend evictions out into a second or third month They're increasing the costs, increasing the difficulty of providing those services that we're there to provide for the community.
So are you hearing them? When they don't get paid their rent, it means it makes their jobs not just harder, but more financially untenable. When we talk about the fact that some people can't pay their rent, okay, I understand that. We I think, are overestimating the amount of people who, due to the coronavirus, can't afford their rent. We know in the city of Olympia, Renata Rawlins, the council member, she's taking a position that she can't afford. She might not be able to afford rent at some point in the future. Right now, she has the money, but she's choosing not to. Oh, and by the way, it's part of my political position. I stand in solidarity with people who can't actually afford to pay the rent. The fact of the matter is, you've got some people who are taking advantage of these rules by not paying their rent. Renata Rawlins should be evicted because she can easily afford to pay it. She's choosing not to, and she's taking advantage of these landlords, and she's taking advantage of the governor who put in what I assume was a well-intended bill or an eviction, a non-eviction directive. I assume it's because we want to protect people. But the fact of the matter is, and we've talked to enough landlords on this show and elsewhere where they say they're not just going to evict someone if there is a real reason why they can't actually afford it. And if it's due to the coronavirus, they're going to work for you. But you've got bad faith folks who are taking advantage of this, and it's putting people like Kurt in a really tough spot. He has to be able to pay that handyman. He has to pay that plumber. He has to pay the landscaper that he is hiring to service his buildings, to service his customers. So I hope as we have these conversations and continue to have these conversations, we at least understand the other side. Thank you so much for tuning into the Jason Rancho. Really do appreciate it. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.